This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're featuring poets on this archive edition. Stephen Spender once wrote about my guest, poet W.S. Merwin. It's as though things write their own poems through Merwin. At their best, they are poems of total attention, and as such, they protest against our world of total distraction. Merwin has been honored with the Pulitzer Prize for his poetry. Four of his books were published in new paperback editions last year. Merwin grew up in an area of Pennsylvania that has since been strip-mined. He's written many poems about the beauty of the natural world and the consequences of man's desecration of it. He now lives in Hawaii. I spoke with him in 1988 and asked him to read a poem that isn't about nature. It's about love and memory and having entered the world before the one you love.
Being early. When you were born, I was a small child in a city. And even if somebody had brought me news of you, I would not have believed them. Already I had seen an ape chained in the sun with a bucket of water. I had heard bells calling from wooden towers, stone towers, brick towers. I had seen blood coming through bandages on a hand holding candy and a shadow shining on green water where tall birds were standing. And I knew the notes of streetcars and the smells of three rivers and could have told you about all of them if I had known you were there.
I think that's really a beautiful poem. And I was wondering, what got you thinking about being born before your love was?
Well, no, it was the other way around. I mean, of course.
You being born before she was, yes.
Yes, because she's a bit younger, a few years younger than I am.
Yeah.
My wife. She's not very many years younger than I am, but enough for me to think about that. There were several years when she wasn't around.
There's a really striking image in the poem. You say that you'd seen blood coming through bandages on a hand holding candy. And it's amazing how certain images just stay with you. I mean, do you remember when you actually saw that?
Oh, I do. Yes, I can remember. I must have been about 2 years old, and I was playing with some older girls. I mean, I thought of them as thoroughly grown up. They must have been all of 7 or 8, and I was 2. And one of them got hurt one day. And, you know, when there are tiny children around, they always try to hush it up and not let you know what happened.
Right.
And I was very curious, and they lived upstairs, and I remember the silence and after the crying stopped, and then the two girls coming downstairs. I was made to wait down at the bottom of the stairs, one of those old houses down in Florida that had wooden steps coming down the back, you know. And I was supposed to wait down at the bottom. And I waited down there because I wanted to find out what happened. They came down, and there was this bandage with the blood coming through, and they both had new pieces of toffee candy that they were eating to make them feel better. I didn't get any.
Was that a very frightening image to you?
Well, it was curious, you know. There's a sort of Buddhist image of what one's existence in life is, that pleasure and pain are always mixed, and they talk about, you know, honey on a razor. It's that funny mixture. It's both exciting and frightening and something that one's both drawn to and repelled by, you know.
Yeah. Well, one last thing about this poem, Being Early, which you just read. It ends with, I could have told you about all of them, all of these images, if I had known you were there. And, I mean, that's really like the writer's desire, isn't it, to tell?
Yes.
I mean, to tell
yes,
people
is.
About things. Mm. And I wonder if you can explain your need or your desire to tell, to write, to describe.
If I could explain it, you know, it might go away. It's there all the time. And yet, you know, I don't think anybody ever knows exactly who they wanted. Some poems, you know, that you want to go to one specific person. And sometimes there's a poem in which there's someone, an image over one's shoulder, you know, that you're writing for. But there's always, I think you're always writing for everybody, don't you think? You know, everybody's experience, which they share with you and you share with them, and the experience behind a poem like that is not going to be anybody else's. And yet, if it works, they're going to recognize something in their own lives that is the same.
Well, one of the things that interests me about your desire to tell, your desire to describe, is that you come from what you describe as a reticent family, a family of people who really didn't talk very much at all.
Yes, that's true. But that didn't make any difference. I can remember when I was very young listening to music, and I don't even think it was very very interesting and very good music, but I was trying to explain what was wonderful about the music. And there was no way, I mean, nobody, there was no way of getting through to anybody. And of course, this is always there. I think there are always two sides to this thing. You, finally, it's impossible to say what any experience is like to anybody else. And yet the miraculous thing about literature is that it does say so much it does allow one to, you know, this much misused word now, share. It does allow one to share experience with other people. Literally share it, the way you share a piece of bread or something like that, you know, when one person has one part of it and the other person has another part of it. And you recognize something that you have in common. And this is, you know, this is one of the really hopeful things about being alive, that one can do that. Can you imagine not being able to do it at all? The terrible isolation?
Sure.
Some people suffer that.
You always describe poetry as using language as a vehicle for the unsayable.
That's it. It is unsayable. And one makes these kind of incursions on the unsayable, but of course the unsayable is infinite. There's no way, finally, of saying it. But we do say the most extraordinarily intimate and true things sometimes, and it's always amazing that we can do it. When you think that language is something that no one of us made, it's something that we inherit and pick up as we go along, and it's and the, you know, the word for the color red is the word for all of the colors red, and yet when we use it, we're talking about something very specific, and sometimes people can hear it and see something very specific out of their own lives.
We're featuring a 1988 interview with poet W.S. Merwin. More of that interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1988 interview with poet W.S. Merwin.
You studied poetry with John Berryman at Princeton.
I did.
And you have a poem that I very much like that you wrote about advice that he gave you about poetry. And I'd really like it if you read that poem for us. And this is, my guess is W.S. Merwin, who has a new volume of poems called The Rain in the Trees. But this is an earlier poem that I'm asking you to read now.
It's out of the book that came before The Rain in the Trees, which is Opening the Hand, and it's now in the selected poems, too. And the poem is called Berryman. I will tell you what he told me in the years just after the war, as we then called the Second World War. Don't lose your arrogance yet, he said. You can do that when you're older. Lose it too soon and you may merely replace it with vanity. Just one time, he suggested, changing the usual order of the same words in a line of verse. Why point out a thing twice? He suggested I pray to the muse. Get down on my knees and pray right there in the corner, and he said he meant it, literally. It was in the days before the beard and the drink, but he was deep in tides of his own through which he sailed, chin sideways and head tilted like attacking a sloop. He was far older than the dates allowed for, much older than I was. He was in his 30s. He snapped down his nose with an accent I think he had affected in England. As for publishing, he advised me to paper my wall with rejection slips. His lips and the bones of his long fingers trembled with the vehemence of his views about poetry. He said the great presence that permitted everything and transmuted it in poetry was passion. Passion was genius, and he praised movement and invention. I had hardly begun to read. I asked, how can you ever be sure that what you write is really any good at all? And he said, you can't. You can't. You can never be sure. You die without knowing whether anything you wrote was any good. If you have to be sure, don't write.
Gosh, I like that. At the end, you know, of the poem there, where he gives you that advice that if you have to be sure that your poems are good, don't write. I mean, was that really plaguing you a lot? How do you know if your poems are good?
Oh, no, it was a kind of a great relief. It made me feel that, you know, you couldn't kind of footsie around with it. You know, if you were... we're going to write for the wrong reasons, and I think this is wonderful advice for anybody starting out. You know, if you're going to write for the wrong reasons, you'll reap the results of writing for the wrong reasons. If it's just an ego gratification, or if it's just for money and status and those things, well, you may get those things, but they're never going to be very satisfying.
But, you know, I think a lot of artists are really fueled by self-confidence, that they really believe in their stuff so much, they really believe that it's good.
That's great.
And it's that self-confidence that, you know, enables them to survive different, hard economic times or, you know, other insecurities.
Well, I think that's true, and I think it should never be forgotten. I mean, I see young writers who are very concerned about how big an advance they can get for their first book and the status that it's going to lead them to. And, you know, I understand that, and everything in the society pushes them that way. But I think it's very important to realize that almost anybody that we really admire as we grow up, and thinking of Van Gogh or Rambo or you know, Beethoven or anybody of the really great figures, there were periods in their lives in most cases in which they really had no money, and which the only thing that kept them going was this passion for what they wanted to do.
I would like to ask you to read one final poem before we have to conclude. Now, since I've chosen all of the poems so far, I thought I'd give you the opportunity to to choose one you especially would like to read.
Well, what about the first poem in The Rain in the Trees, which is called Late Spring? Coming into the high room again after years, after oceans and shadows of hills and the sounds of lies, after losses and feet on stairs, after looking and mistakes and forgetting, turning there thinking to find no one except those I knew, finally I saw you sitting in white, already waiting. You of whom I had heard with my own ears since the beginning, for whom more than once I had opened the door, believing you were not far.
When did you write that? And what were the circumstances behind the writing of it?
I wrote it in New York in the summer of 1982 sometime. The circumstances. Oh, you mean, well, I was with my wife and I was thinking about meeting her.
Mm-hmm. You know, in so many of your poems, you seem so surprised to have had such a wonderful relationship with one woman. I just seem perpetually surprised in your poems about that.
Oh, I think it's a very surprising thing to be alive, isn't it?
Well, yeah.
And that's the most wonderful thing that can happen, is to have that kind of relation with somebody. I mean, that's the most, so it's the most surprising thing of all.
Poet W.S. Merwin, recorded in 1988.